1, 2, 3, 4.
How can we free our minds to cultivate curiosity, innovation, and creativity in our daily lives? In this age of AI, where creative tasks are increasingly being performed for us, what is intelligence? And what is the future of education? Duncan Wardle was Vice President of Innovation and Creativity at Disney and has helped organizations like Apple, the NBA, Coca-Cola, and Spotify to innovate. The Imagination Emporium, Creative Recipes for Innovation, is a book and toolkit with easy-to-use recipes to make innovation and creativity accessible and fun. Duncan Wardle, welcome to The Creative Process.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So you've just published your book, The Imagination Emporium, Creative Recipes for Innovation, which is really like a culmination of your experience at Disney and other organizations heralding a lot of their really big creative initiatives. Your book also includes audio segments. It's very visual. I mean, there's drawings in every page showing you the creative process, not just talking about it. So you just tell us about the formation of this book.
Firstly, I wanted it to be accessible to normal, hardworking, busy people, because we've all got things to do. So I thought about, what book have I ever read where I could just read one page and get what I want out of it? I thought, my mum's cookbook, right? You want shepherd's pie, you go to page 67. So the book is designed the same way. And it says, for example, on the contents page, have you ever been to a brainstorm and nothing ever happened? Work in a heavily regulated industry, go to page 14. So I want to make it tangible. And as you mentioned, I also wanted to appeal to all three learning styles, be that the people who learn by listening. There's a Spotify playlist for the people who learn by seeing. There's animated videos. And the people who learn by doing, the back QR code is actually the first fully integrated artificial intelligence book produced, where you can actually ask the book how to use the tools to solve a given challenge. I define creativity as the ability to have an idea. I believe every single person is creative. I don't believe in this phrase called the creatives, but I believe innovation is the ability to get it done. Obviously, that's the hard part. But what I wanted to do was, we tried four models of innovation and creativity at Disney. Bob Iger's goal was, how might we embed a culture of innovation and creativity into everybody's DNA? So we tried hiring external consultants, we tried creating a team, we did an accelerator program, but we failed in our overall goal, which was, how might we embed a culture of innovation in creativity, everybody's DNA. So I decided to take and create a toolkit. And this is sort of the combination of that toolkit, if you will. This really takes innovation and makes it tangible, makes it accessible to normal, hardworking people, makes creativity tangible for those people who are a little bit afraid of ambiguity, but far more importantly, makes the process fun. Give people tools they choose to use when you and I are not around.
There are all these different kinds of learning and there are all these modalities. And I think that, you know, being a fully successful creative is also listening and learning. It's about understanding that people experience the world in different ways. We all have this creative capacity. And I think that it's helpful to think about, which you might be somewhat familiar, but you do give this kind of fun rebranding of the four stages of the brain. And I think that we can't always be having those, you know, completely groundbreaking ideas all the time. So maybe when we're not feeling that way, we can do some of the more conventional alpha, but you call it amazing alpha, the thoughtful theta. You know, when we're not buzzing with ideas, maybe we can do some of the other, you know, so we can always be working, but we can just be working at what we feel in the moment. And then maybe if we're not feeling it, but we still have to get things done, how do we cultivate? How do we bring about those creative states? Because I guess there's been some science on this too, that we can kind of stimulate it in lots of different ways.
Yeah, look, when you ask people, where are you and what are you doing, where you get best ideas, people say shower, bathroom, walking, jogging, running. Nobody ever says at work, right? So, and it's kind of like when you're in an argument and you turn to walk away the argument, you immediately come up with a killer one-liner. Well, how do I get there? How do I get to just your point? How do I get into that brain state when I need it on demand? I run energizers. There's a whole bunch of them in the book. They're 60-second exercises. Well, what are they for? Specifically designed to make you laugh. Because the moment I hear laughter, I know that metaphorically I've placed you back in the shower and I've opened that door just wide enough between your conscious and subconscious brain to move you out of beta, which is where we are when we say, I don't have time to think, and into alpha, into that brain state where we are when we have our best ideas.
Before we had this conversation, I was just listening to the great late Ken Robinson, who also wrote in the space about creativity. And it's just about the laughter, because it reminded me, he brought, like the greatest philosophers too, people think about philosophy as being a stale subject, but like humor is the way to bring across illuminations. And then it takes away that fear, which is so often with a lot of people associated with creativity. We can laugh, we can shake things up a bit, and then the ideas can flow.
Yeah, I think for most of us, you know, we say that time to think is the biggest barrier to innovation. I would argue it's our own river of thinking. Well, what's a river of thinking? I think it's our own expertise and our own experience. The more we have, the faster, the wider, and the deeper is our river of thinking, allowing us to make quick and informed decisions. But we don't get to think the way we've always thought. In the last 4 years, we've had global pandemics. We've had global climate change. We've got Generation Z entering the workforce, and now we have AI. So basically, the tools of the toolkit, which are brought to you by Nova, are actually designed to stop you thinking the way you always do and give you permission to think differently.
What's interesting with AI, because we have an AI in the Future of Humanity podcast channel as well. It's so interesting. It's so innovative, AI, but it's in many ways a sophisticated plagiarism tool. I mean, whatever you think about it, it empowers people who maybe were never creative in the particular space. Now they can become a painter, but they never learned how to paint. I think it's important to have the years of learning an instrument or whatever it is. So it's empowered people. But at the same time, I think eventually that it also is, becomes an equalizer, but it then at the same time we start to reproduce the same things because we're talking about the river of thoughts, river of thinking. We'll be feeding from this same stream that it'll start churning out, you know, the algorithms. Here it's yep. the sameness. So it's innovative, but then it becomes same.
Yeah, I think one of the blessings, you know, because I think everybody wakes up in the morning sort of a bit nervous about AI, but excited about AI, and we just vacillate backwards and forwards. If we consider that the number one barrier to innovation is I don't have time to think, well, what's AI about to do for us? It's about to, it's going to do our weekly reports, our expense reports, our complaints. It's going to do all the mundane stuff that actually will give us time to think, and I think that's a blessing. I've been working with Google on their DeepMind project, which is their AI project, and I asked the lead engineer what she considered would be the biggest barriers to what AI, how will we compete with what she's developing? She said, with the things that she believed are the things that will be the most employable skill sets of the short term will actually be those things that will be the hardest for her to program into AI. And I asked her what they were. She said, the things which you were born, imagination, creativity, curiosity, empathy, and intuition. Will they be programmed one day? And there was no today. Anytime in the next few years? Probably not. But one of the biggest challenges is we go to school, and the very first thing our teacher tells us to do is don't forget to color in between the lines. The next thing they say is stop asking why, because they don't want one right answer. And so I believe that most of us grow up, and by the time we're 18, and I did a speech at a local university where I asked 3,000 students and one first grade class to put their hands up if they were creative. 30 little hands just shot me, but the other 3,000 stayed down. And so I believe Western education is one of the biggest killers of some of the most employable skill sets of the next decade. But that's why I wanted to very specifically to make the imagination emporium playful.
I do agree that education, formal education, although I think that education, we should be educating and learning all our lives. AI, on the other hand, has this other thing about, we won't stay too much on this, but perfection, like this note, the algorithmic perfection. And that kind of seems to operate in the same way of exams and a right answer, whatever. And so that's where the thing for me is that it doesn't have enough oxygen to those mistakes that happen just through living and living in the world, you know, like there's no smooth roads, you know.
Oh, so I'll give you that's a really great example, actually, because if you go back to the early days of The Lunch at Pixar, which was God knows how many years ago, sort of four or five people around a table just talking with no data, no algorithms, no consumers, just talking about their own childhoods. And in that time, in that it's called The Lunch in Disney lore, they came up with storylines and character development, Finding Nemo, Wally, Cars, Monsters Incorporated, and Toy Story. By talking about their childhoods, somebody was, you know, the 60s kid and, you know, man hadn't landed on the moon yet and cowboys were gods. But the day that Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, cowboys were gone. Oh, I used to have monsters underneath my bed. And just by not using data, Pixar is particularly good at empathy as well. If you think of Wally in the opening sequence of the film, here we have this very dusty, rusty robot who can't talk, he's mute. And yet in the opening sequence of the film, we instantly feel empathy for Wally because we see he watches television. He sees two celebrities hold hands. And we instantly see in his eyes he desires to be loved. And so those are the things that I think will be very hard to program into AI. Will they one day?
That's great having a window because a lot of people would love to have that experience behind the scenes at Pixar or Disney. Could you tell us briefly about some of those projects that you thought, wow, you were so happy to be a part of?
So for the opening of Toy Story, I decided it'd be a really good idea to have Buzz Lightyear's dream come true. And somebody said, well, how are you going to do that? I said, well, his dream was to fly. He couldn't. He was a toy. So I thought, well, I'm going to send him into space. Of course, I hadn't had that conversation with NASA at the time. So I met with 23 people at NASA, and finally they agreed to take Buzz Lightyear into space. About 6 months into the before launch, I got a call from Johnson Space Center saying, we need Buzz Lightyear here tomorrow. I said, why? They said, well, we need two identical Buzz Lightyears here tomorrow. I was like, why? They said, well, we're going to have to take one apart molecule by molecule because there's a bubble inside the plastic that could explode in the vacuum of space and potentially into an astronaut. So I had 37 cast members at Walmart, Target, trying to find Buzz Lightyear. And at the time, of course, Buzz was sold out. So we found one, but couldn't find the other. I thought, the deadline's coming up. So I'm in my car. This is the days before smartphones. So I got a call, but you couldn't see who it was. And all I had was to infinity and beyond. I was like, who is this? And it was my wife. She goes, Lydia. I said, oh, where'd you get it? She goes, oh, it's been underneath James's bed collecting dust. So I wrote James on his foot. And I sent the two Buzzes off to NASA. I said, look, don't destroy this Buzz Lightyear because this is a real little boy's Buzz Lightyear. So 6 months later, we were invited down to the launch. I got quite emotional. I was like, my little boy's going to space. And then he is, in fact, the longest consecutive astronaut serving in space. He served on the International Space Station for 18 months. And then we're launching another Toy Story. So I thought, how do you beat sending Buzz Lightyear into space? I thought, I'm going to give him hope. So I phoned up the director of comms at NASA. I said, when are you bringing Buzz back? There was total silence on the phone. I said, no man left behind, right? He says, you've got to be kidding. That was never part of the contract. I said, well, you bring everything back, right? He said, no, we don't. I said, well, what do you do with it? He goes, well, just push it out of the hatch. I was like, oh, you can't incinerate Buzz Lightyear in the Earth's atmosphere. I'll leak it to the world's press that NASA killed Buzz Lightyear. So God bless NASA. They agreed to bring Buzz home, but he landed in California because the weather was bad. I have the passenger manifest, the actual piece of paper. Seat 1A, congressman, blah, blah, blah. Seat 32B, astronaut, blah, blah. Seat 42A, commander. Buzz Lightyear. He's been given a promotion. And now you can find him in the Aerospace Museum in Washington, D.C. with a little bronze plaque underneath him that says, gift of James Wardle, aged 8.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, that's a real example, obviously, of thinking outside of the box or even thinking outside of the planet. And, you know, you mentioned there this was being done before smartphones. You're talking about having time to think, or people are now finding it difficult to pay attention. We have the distraction and then just the further acceleration of AI. With all these things going on, to have that, to tap into one's consciousness, which is, you know, collective, I guess, if you're in a group, but also we need that space, that stillness. To get that vision, you kind of need to turn off the lights, right? You know, the magic happens in the dream space of our head. So how do you find that? And do you find it's been affected by phones or these technologies? How do you stimulate it with your imagination, but how do you also destimulate it?
So when you ask people, you know, if you go to a restaurant, you look at the menu, you listen to the specials, and then do you order the same thing every time? People put their hand up. Then you ask, do you get in the bed, same side of the bed every night? Yes, put the hand up. Even when you're in a hotel room by yourself? Yes, put your hand up. Do you ever commute home backwards and forwards and you get home and there's just that split second when you arrive home and you just think, man, how did I get home? Here's what happened on the way home. And it's the same with our lives. Because we go past the same stimulus and do the same mundane things every single day, our brain physically shuts down. But it didn't wake up till you got home. So how do you get to that brain state? No fresh stimulus in, no new ideas out. So there's different companies do it different ways. Microsoft has Think Week. Google has 20% time for their engineers. No, it's not an urban myth. I'm working with them. Pixar has unplanned collaborations, specifically designed to bring two people together who were not supposed to meet to have a conversation they weren't supposed to have to spark a new idea. Well, I call it a freshness meeting. We do it once a month. And it's one, and perhaps people could try it. You can't ask your boss, could I have Fridays off? I need time to think. But what if you took 1 hour a month from 9 till 10 a.m., the first Friday of every month, and ask your teams to come in individually or virtually, and ask them to come in and just talk about something they've seen in their life in the last 30 days, in their business life, or ideally their personal life that they thought was innovative or creative. You'll be amazed at the amount of new ideas and energy you drive back into the organization.
And so you talk about diversity of perspectives and random connections. And so since I know that you've given workshops in different countries, where different countries have different cultures of creativity, and they're creative in different ways. Like some might have more collective cultures, but then you have to, you tap into it, you know, culturally there might be events or rituals or dancing or things like this to get them to free up. So how do you find your way in those different diverse situations, whether in different business cultures, different actual physical cultures and countries?
I was tasked, 5 or 6 years ago now, to go to the Derby slum in Mumbai. There's about 1 million people living in an area about the size of 8 Disney theme parks. And to a certain extent, you would think squalor, and to a certain extent, you'd be right. The level of entrepreneurialism, innovation, and creativity taking place in that slum would far outstrip any of us. If I ask you, who are the most creative people you've ever met? People say children. You say, how much money they got? None. So our task was to create light where there was no electricity. For 1 million people. It's a pro bono project. I hadn't got a clue what I was doing, but I thought, I'll give it a go. I was sitting in a cafe outside of the slum, which did have electricity, with a couple of kids from the slum. And we were just playing and being curious like children. And we noticed that when we were holding a plastic bottle with our water in it, when the light hit it, it refracted the light around the bottle onto the tablecloth, creating a little ring of light. So one kid picked up the bottle and laughed because the ring of light got bigger. So I thought, hang on a minute, what if I take the advertising label off the bottle? And somebody said, well, what if I take the lid off the bottle? They were just being curious, like children. And then I thought, well, what if I put the water closer to the light source? So I stood on the chair and about a height of 12 foot, I could get that ring of light out about 3.5 feet. It wasn't particularly a strong light. So the chap who went out there with me said, but put some chlorine in it, you'll magnify the light. So he walked out to a hut next door, stuffed the bottle through that hole in the ceiling and lit the hut during daylight hours. Wrote to a mate of mine who works for Evian in Paris, who used to work at Disney. I said, you're about to trash the planet with 1 million empty bottles. He goes, yeah, right. What's your point? I said, well, send them to me for free. Take your advertising off the side. We need the light. And 6 weeks later, we lit 1 million huts with no electricity and no money by being curious like a child. And this is where we're all born imaginative. We play with the box, not the toy in our holidays. We used to ask why, and why again. But unfortunately, Western education is killing it because we are being told to colour in between the lines or stop asking why. And so why do I believe that India will be the largest world superpower by 2070? Not because their population surpassed China this year, not because they have a much younger population, not because a much greater percentage of the population speaks English. Nobody is killing their imagination. Nobody is killing their creativity or their curiosity or their empathy. And they're 1.4 billion entrepreneurs against the Western education system. I'll take that bet.
No, obviously it's a powerhouse, because I also think that China's economic model of capitalism, you know, merged with state socialism is an interesting model. And did you come across other environmental innovations? Because we have to be really innovative to mitigate climate change in this crucial decade. We need creative solutions. We need economically affordable solutions. And we need ones that we can accelerate and spread quickly because we're in a crucial decade.
Yeah, this is a fascinating chap. He's based out of Houston, Texas. I think he's either late 20s or early 30s. And he is now printing houses in Houston, Texas for $1,500 in 5 days that are fully sustainable. And the first houses he printed, so to speak, he actually gave to the homeless people. And so you start to think about, wow, we can make some real change here. So I think another piece of technology that will help with global climate change, I don't know exactly how it will help just yet. Well, maybe it will. So for example, okay, today we go to a Boston Red Sox game or a Liverpool Football Club game, but we've got to travel to get there. We've got to get trains and planes and cars and everything else. And think of all the pollution that that causes. Well, I've been doing some experiments where I sat in the dugout out of a very famous baseball team live during the game, and I was sat next to the players. No, I was in the Apple store in London wearing an Apple Vision Pro. And so today it's too expensive, okay, understood, and it's too big. But now think 5 years from now or 7 years from now, it'll be a pair of glasses. 10 years from now, will it be contact lenses? So Johnny sitting in Cairo won't have to fly to Boston to watch the baseball game. He could pay a dollar and sit at home and sit at the back of the stadium, $5 on the halfway line and $10, and he'll sit in the dugout.
No, that's the kind of innovative thinking. It's renaming, rethinking. And the other side of that, too, is a lot of the things that we think of as innovation, like coming out of, say, Silicon Valley or things like disruptors like Uber or Airbnb, you know, they're kind of just tweaking up, you know, things that already exist. People want to stay at a place. Here's some people who want to rent their place. Here's taxi drivers. Here's people who want to get to where they want to go. It's an innovation, but it's just kind of an acceleration. And somebody from Silicon Valley told me, been in it for years, is that the successful companies, a lot of them, you know, they're taking some ideas that somebody else had and they're just like industrializing it. Often it's not even innovation so much as just acceleration or expanding upon something. You know, I guess it is a different kind of innovation, but just tell me a little bit how you maybe grew ideas from just being something could be niche, but, you know, now it's ubiquitous.
No, that's fair. So look, and you talked about how to reframe a challenge. Well, Walt Disney was the master of reframing challenges. There's a tool in the book called How Else? How might we simply reframe our challenge to help us think differently? He said we will not have any employees in our park or customers. We will only have cast members and guests. With that simple reframing of the relationship between the two, he created a culture of hospitality that's rarely being repeated elsewhere. If I were to ask people, if we're going into business and open a car wash, what should we put in it? The first words they're going to say water, soap, brushes, dryer, vacuum, people. You say, well, what if we call it an auto spa? What could we put in it? Now you'll hear robes, masseuses, champagne, aromatherapy, music, etc. All I did was reframe the challenge to stop us thinking the way we always do, that river of thinking, and get us to think differently. Yeah, we'd have put the gate price up, but you don't get to iterate in a post-pandemic world. And so we reframed the challenge and said, instead of saying, how might we make more money? We said, how might we solve the biggest consumer pain point? Everybody knew what it was. It was called standing in line. And so I said, well, what if there were no lines? Well, nobody knew the answer at the time. So we used another tool, which I call Where Else, which is in the book. This is about most insights for innovation will come from looking outside of your industry, not from looking within. So we asked ourselves, where in the world has somebody already solved the challenge of people not standing in line? And we found a very small pharmacy in Tokyo, Japan, using RFID technology to enable people not to stand in line. All we did was put RFID in a little magic band. We call it Disney's Magic Band. It is your room key today. You don't check in or check out. It's your theme park ticket. The turnstiles are gone. It's your reservations for your favorite character meet and greets or your favorite rides. You can pay for merchandise with it and have it sent to your hotel room. You can organize your food so you walk into the restaurant when you want to walk in, sit at the table you want to sit at, and the food comes fresh to you. Had we have started by saying, how might we make more money? Yeah, we'd have made 3%, but by reversing it from the consumer's point of view, the average guest at Walt Disney World today has 2 hours free time each and every day. They didn't have that results in record intent to recommend, record intent to return, and record revenues. What do we do with our free time in Disney parks? We spend money. And so, and what are people doing every second of every day? They're live crowdsourcing the future products and services of everything Disney creates by telling them every second of every day what they like and what they don't. So, yes, but again, I was waiting for an appointment up in New York, sat chatting to the young lady behind the reception desk. I got upstairs, said to the boss, your reception is so friendly, so helpful, so lovely. And just, he said, oh, that was nice. How long were you chatting to her for? I said, about 10 minutes, I suppose. He says, oh, that's odd. I said, well, why is that odd? He said, well, we don't have a receptionist. I thought, well, who the hell was I talking to for the last 10 minutes? He said, well, I said, well, no, hang on. Her name was Sarah. She had a summer dress on because it had no sleeves. He goes, oh, Sarah. Sarah's our director of first impressions. It's like, boom, that simple re-expression of a form of employment empowered to own the space she was.
It's an entry job. And it's true. It's the first person that you meet in an organization, you know, that can affect your whole relationship. We talked there a little bit about education. And I know you do give these lectures at Yale and other schools. As much as AI is shaking that up, we are having to rethink what we think about what is intelligence. You know, at the present rate, people have to get more and more qualifications to not even have a guaranteed job. And AI, it's taking jobs away from coders. You know, who thought you could, you know, do away with the coders? How do we change education? How do we educate people for the future in a way that they do have a bit of security? Yeah. And I think everyone's creative, but not everyone does have that entrepreneurial instinct, and there aren't guaranteed jobs for life anymore.
I think that's very fair. I think education is broken. I think it's been broken for a long time. AI has now smashed education to the ground. And I don't believe that these big universities will be here by 2040. I think the future of education is gaming because it's creative problem solving 101. You get to choose your own avatar, your own costume, your own challenge, your own adventure, your own team. People ask me if they think gaming is killing creativity. No, it's not. It is creative problem solving 101. So today, the traditional lecture, I go into the lecture hall, the professor goes, wah, 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 and I fall asleep. But in virtual reality and in gaming, I can now walk into the Senate in Rome, debate with the senators and tell Julius Caesar, look behind you. My son came down to breakfast at the age of 14 and said, do you know the Doge's palace was built in Venice in 1438? And he went into enormous details like, wow, did you learn that at school? He goes, no, Assassin's Creed. It's like, wow. I think gaming is the future of education. And I think education is, it's a disgrace that your children today are learning the same thing that I did because I went to school a very, very long time ago.
And that's the creative aspect of it. And I do think it does give this kind of 3D experience. It can bring us back into ancient, right up face to face to the ancient world and give us that visualization. The way your book, The Creative Emporium, helps different kinds of learning. There is this other shadow aspect of it, is that we are becoming a little disembodied. Like, I believe in embodied intelligence. Like, they're dancers, they're people who actually think with their body first, and then it comes up to their brain last, you know? So how do we keep hold on to that, this self that we have uniquely, the AI doesn't have, it never walked on the earth. For you personally, how do you reconnect with the earth, with nature, to recharge your ideas, to get these thoughts, and be inspired by the beauty and wonder of nature, which has a lot of great ideas too?
Yeah, I play a lot. I can still see rabbits and not clouds. I can see elephants if I want to. I'll look at a tree and suddenly I'll imagine it's something completely different. So I'm very playful. I'm deliberately playful. When we ask who are the most creative people you've ever met, everybody says children. And they are. And what do they do better than us? They play. Playfulness is very important. They nurture. They're always nurturing ideas. We children think expansively. We think reductively. We're always worried about how we're going to get it done or it won't work because that's the way we tried it last year. As much as we can, you'll see a lot of the creative. The book is divided between the energizers, which get you into the fun brain state. The tools are the how do I actually get this innovation done and taken to market. The creative behaviors really are the oil that drives the engine. The innovation tools are the engine, but you need oil to make it work. I believe the creative behaviors are far more important in transforming a corporate culture than the innovation tools. If you haven't got the culture right first, the tools won't work.
Yeah. And I guess in closing, as you think back, you mentioned Walt Disney. I mean, great creative, great businessman. He was like the whole package. As you think back of those you've encountered or even from history, those people that you learned from or even just learned from a distance, you know, who were those inspiring figures for you in your own life? Who kind of taught you, who brought you on your journey? And what did you learn from them? And what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Richard Branson, number one. Why? Think about all the things Richard's tried that have failed. Coca-Cola's gone, vodka's gone, Virgin Massages are gone, Virgin Mobile, I think that's gone, Virgin Stores, they've gone. Do we think of Richard as an unsuccessful person? No. But do you ever hear anybody, even in print, say Richard Branson's CEO? No. They call him an entrepreneur. He's one of the very few people that actually believe in employees first. All these CEOs talk it, but they don't believe it. Richard does. And I think the fact that he is not afraid to try and fail, which gives him that entrepreneurial, the whole Virgin vibe is an entrepreneurial spirit. But the person I love working for the most was Michael Eisner, who was CEO before Bob Iger. People don't give Michael enough credit. He saved the company single-handedly in 1984 when it was about to be split up and turned what was a family brand into a global brand. And I loved Michael because every time he walked in the door with an idea, he'd smile and he was always very polite and respectful and courteous. He goes, yeah, no, not big enough. We're the world's largest entertainment company. Come back when you've got something that scares me. You're like, all right then. And I took that as a challenge. So I loved working for him.
Yeah, exactly. You're not just measured by your successes. You're measured about your failures and how you keep on getting back on that horse. Yeah. It's the resilience, the adaptability, and the intuitive intelligence. All those are great examples. And I think that for those who want, whether you're coming from a background in business, you're a student, you just want to kind of tap into those creative juices, I think that the Imagination Emporium, Creative Recipes for Innovation, it gives you a pathway in. So thank you, Duncan Wardle, for what you've done to nurture creativity, empower innovation, reframe our challenges into opportunities. By helping us think beyond our limitations, we can create a better tomorrow. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you very much.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and your name. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk, additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.